Welcome to episode 67 of the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast. Today is January the 6th, 2012. I am Matthew Dean Furlough, and this is my New Year celebrating brother, James Furlough.
I heard you got a little miserable yesterday.
Oh man, not yesterday. Yesterday I got unchained. The day before I got miserable. Yeah, I was. This weekend was a good weekend for movies. I saw Les Miserables on Friday night. And then I watched Django Unchained yesterday, and both intense and pretty fantastic movies in their own way. You probably won't like Django, but I think you'd like Les Mis.
Jesse wants to go see it, so it'll probably happen at some point.
Yeah, it's a good one. I had friends that have been fans of, like, they would like regularly go to the stage version of it in San Francisco like twice a year, and I didn't understand why they liked it so much, and after watching the movie I'm like, yeah, I could see how that would be pretty cool actually as a stage production.
Well, at first I tried with Jesse, I was like, I think it's in French, I don't think you'll understand it, and then she like she was like, no, well let me look, so she looked, she's like, no, I think it's in English. I was like, dang,
yeah,
okay,
it's,
well,
not bad. You don't mind musicals, right? I mean,
no, I don't.
Okay, I don't. Yeah, same.
But you hear, like, you get a kick out of this. This Saturday, we didn't go anywhere. Instead, we were watching Dogs, because Jesse and I signed up for Dog Vacay, which is like Airbnb for pets, basically.
Nice.
So we watched these dogs. Okay. There are two of them. The first one, the male, his name was Pippin. And the second one, the female, her name was Mary.
Nice.
And the owners were dropping them off so that they could go up to Portland in 3D IMAX, watch, care to guess, what movie?
I'm guessing it's not Les Mis. The Hobbit.
No. Yeah, they were like, yeah, we're kind of big Tolkien fans. I was like, yeah, I hope to shout.
I can tell.
You're paying, like, money for people to watch your pets while you go watch a movie. That's amazing.
That's hilarious. Oh
yeah,
my goodness.
It's pretty awesome. It's like, man, you guys are super fans. That's awesome.
You've seen The Hobbit, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. In 24 frames, 2D.
Oh, super lame.
I know. But it's all right. It was still good. Yeah. I liked it. I was bummed when it ended. I was like, ah, there's still more to go. Why are we stopping? But I understand.
Yeah, there's
some people
got to
use the banyo.
There's two more three-hour movies to follow.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
So
it's crazy. Anyways, thus ending our regular movie review section of the podcast. This week, we're not going to be talking about movies. You know what? I don't even know why I say that we're not going to be talking about movies, because we do almost every week. But what we actually came here to talk about is technology and the continuing corporate opera, or the soap opera of corporations' dealings back and forth, the people working for them, their marketing campaigns, and the technology they're developing. Before we get into the heart of the show, James has got a short disclosure that he'd like to throw out there.
Yeah, I work for HP. However, during this podcast, I do not represent HP or any of their opinions.
But what we do throw it around as though it makes all of his opinions more valid.
That's true.
For the sake of the show.
Well, I would say that I am informed by my employment with HP.
Ah, yes. That's a good way to put it. So if you want to follow us throughout the week, feel free to do that. My personal Twitter, which carries all sorts of, you know, fun comments and interesting stuff, is at Matthew D. Furlough.
And I am at James Furlough.
And did you see that I finally updated my Twitter profile picture? I've been using the same one for...
No,
since
I
signed up for Twitter like years ago. It's that, and it was
twitter.com/ what was it? Matthew D. Furlough.
Amen.
Loading. Oh. It's a picture of you and the universe. Let's see. You are the unsung hero drinking something.
Yeah, well, Rusty Screw is the name of that drink, but or Rusty Nail. I can't remember. Whatever. It tastes awful.
I don't know.
But No. I wanted to make the because for me, like, for whatever reason, like, Facebook profile, like, I actually, like, rotate through those things kind of regularly. Mm. I didn't find one and have just stuck with it. Whereas, like, Twitter, I had kind of stuck with the rendering of me that was done by one of my friends as a South Park character, and I decided that it's time to look like an adult. So I picked a picture of me drinking, which I'm not sure that was. Anyways, if you want to follow the show podcast, where we give interesting updates about the show and what's going on, and announce scheduled changes for, like, when we'll be doing the show, which will be important, you can check those out at Furlough Bros. That's our main Twitter. But you can also go to the if you can't remember all these different, or you just want a direct link, you can always go to furloughbros.com, and that's our main website, the hub of our universe. We've got all sorts of cool links there. All the articles that we talk about, we host over there. Links to each individual podcast, big archives. It's awesome. I would go check it out if I were you. Check it out all the time. And as we pointed out last week, it's a really good archive of interesting stuff that's happened over the years. So if you're looking for, you know, it's kind of your highlights, place to peruse.
So as you know, it is a new year, and so I just lost a shoe. So in the spirit, thank you.
Zeitgeist.
I was like, the vestiges? That is not the right word.
Vestiges.
I know enough not to say it, but that's the only word I can think of. In the spirit of it being a new year, and listening to listener feedback, how about that?
Yes.
We're going to try some experiments, at least the beginning part of the year. We'll see how this works. There's still stuff I need to figure out how to do. So what this means for you, trusty listeners, is a couple of things. The first one is various times throughout the show, you will hear me go, and you're listening to the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast. That is because I'm going to be experimenting with splitting the show into different segments throughout the week to share with people who, it's going to be awesome, whine and complain about it being too long.
Yeah, they want bite-sized morsels. They can't take the awesomeness of the fire hydrant approach that we go with this podcast.
I get, right? So in an attempt to appease them and amass thousands of followers, I'm going to try it.
Yeah.
So we'll see how that goes. That also means that the current feed is going to become a firehose feed, and we're going to have to create two separate ones, one for the main long show and then one for clips only. And then obviously there'll be the firehose that kind of has it all. I haven't worked out the exact mechanics of how all that's going to work.
I think the goal, though, is that, you know, if you're in iTunes and you got your stuff all set up, hopefully the length of the show actually won't change. We're just going to be trying to break it up into bite-sized morsels so that it's a little bit easier to digest over the course of the week, and gives a little more structure, gives us an opportunity to pause and go to the bathroom if we need to, you know, that sort of fun stuff.
Maybe I don't think anything will. You probably won't notice anything. It'll all be post-processing.
At this point, the thing is that it should be. We're trying to make this as painless as possible, yet at the same time improve the quality of the show and improve your ability to listen to what you want to listen to. So please hang on, and be excited. This is exciting, guys.
Yeah. And the last bit of news is next week the show is going to be done at a different time because I'm teaching a class Sunday nights for like the next 8 weeks, and so I'm not gonna be available. We'll figure it out. I sprung it on Matthew tonight and he was like, I don't know when I'm free.
We don't
have an official time yet.
if you're into the podcast, once again, you won't notice. That's only if you listen to the live broadcast will really affect you.
And now I think we're 15 minutes in and have not talked about tech, which will make for a fun segment.
All right, so I'm going to, That's a good point. Okay, want me to start? I'll start.
Do it.
Okay, HTML5.
Wait. Oh, you're okay. Listening to the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast. Go ahead.
You're going to break out the intro segment as a separate segment?
Okay. I don't know yet.
You're just going to throw like 17 of those in every time we prove it.
I'm feeling it out.
Wait. You're listening to.
I thought about going crazy and doing it after every story. Then I was like, wow, I need to maintain my sanity.
Yeah, no, that'd be rough. Especially because we, you know, we try to keep it organized. But anyways, HTML5 is finally live.
So phew.
This beast that we've been playing around with since the launch of the iPhone 5 years ago. Everybody... What?
So, it wasn't live earlier? I don't understand. I
feel this is what. So this is what happened.
It's like we were soft working opening with. That everyone knew about. With,
right. Well, we were working with HTML4 because there's like these ratifying committees. They basically say these are all the different standards we're putting in place. These are the different things. And so what that's meant to do is that anybody who builds a browser will have to render certain elements. They'll take in your HTML, your hyper markup. Hypertext markup language. So all of like the written out stuff, all your tags and everything, these tags will do this certain thing in this way. And so it's just a very regimented way of doing it so that every browser will render HTML the same way so that you can write your code once or your web page once and it'll work on every browser, which doesn't really work. But by having one standard, it makes it way easier and gets you way closer. Well, Apple got all like persnickety when they launched the iPhone, and Steve Jobs in particular, because he didn't want to have to use
Flash,
and so they just sort of jumped the gun and said we're going to go with the HTML5 standard as it is, and so, which was in the process of being ratified. The problem was that they had to throw in a whole bunch of different things to sort of like pack, because it wasn't done yet, so they had to basically finish it and said, and this is what we're doing, which was the birth of WebKit, which was an open source platform rendering engine that Apple developed. Eventually Google took over the project. Chrome is based on WebKit. Safari is based on it. Mozilla's not, but it borrows from it heavily. IE isn't, and it's driving Microsoft crazy. But finally...
So is HTML5 now compatible with WebKit?
Yeah. Well, see, that's the funny part about this, is that it's like kind of, not entirely.
No.
WebKit's further along than HTML5. But it's like, so yeah, literally like 5 years later, we're finally to the point where we're like setting standards. This is the perfect time for this sort of thing to be happening. But, you know, it's a slow body. They're very thorough. And it's a good thing, but it's now the joke that everybody was like getting on about, I thought was pretty funny, was like, okay, we start the experience countdown timer now. So if you are a headhunter... Listen, if you are a headhunter and you're looking for an employee, you know, a new employee, you can no longer request somebody with 3 to 5 years of HTML5 experience. Because HTML5 didn't technically exist until this week. So it starts now. Everybody has 0 years experience. Of course, but it doesn't change anything. That's the irony in all of this, is it doesn't, it like changes next, well, I don't know if it's really irony, but it changes next to nothing.
It'll change. It'll shape things, you know, 10 years from now.
Well, yeah.
You know, in the sense that WebKit will slowly, you know, in places that it makes sense, conform to HTML5. But I've unfortunately these bodies. I don't even want to say it was ever okay. But they're moving way too slow.
Yeah.
I understand the whole we want to be thorough and stuff like that, but I got an idea. Come out with a standard and then revise it every once in a while instead of waiting until it's perfect.
Right, and I think it's interesting that neither Apple nor Google nor Mozilla Windows are really... What?
Yeah, go ahead.
It's like the whole SIM card. The SIM card thing gets taken care of in a prompt manner because it's all handled by these major corporations that really drive it.
Right.
And the standards body, in my opinion, you know, should be really driven by, you know, it's a little bit different when you're talking about manufacturing standards versus an open standard like HTML. But I don't understand why, like, you get the smartest engineers in the world. They're basically figuring this stuff out as they go. Why aren't these guys also at the same time in parallel working with the standards committee and trying to figure it all out? But it's, you know, it's a turf war in a lot of ways. And, and the HTML body, they are as into the power and control as Apple or Google is in controlling their little dominion and what they do and how they, you know, and their own self-importance, which, you know, and that's, I mean, that's the case of why was Internet Explorer the way it was for years? Because of stupid self-importance. They're trying to leverage yourself and keep your job, basically what it comes down to. If they let Google and Apple take over, they lose their job. You know, and it's not to say that a standard isn't important, but a lot of this slowness and disagreements comes out of the fact that it's, you know, if you weren't important, then why are you here? And so they make sure that they're important. I don't know. I think they exclude the bigger corporations and the other engineers out of the process largely to their detriment. But, you know, that's my opinion on it. But it's live. Yahoo!
Hey! Congratulations. So, get back to work.
Yeah, really.
Work on HTML 5.2 or whatever they're on. Cool. It's kind of like you said, one of those, yay, you did it, not events.
Right.
WebKit wins, at least today. So. Until the next one comes out. So this is kind of exciting. Do you remember Leap Motion?
I do remember them because I have a buddy who works for him. That's trying to get him to.
That's the one that has, it has that sensor bar down at the bottom so that you can basically reach out to the screen using fingers and gestures without actually having to touch the screen. You know, it's got a protocol and programs, you know, can then access it, that kind of stuff. So they had a little bit of a banner week, which is cool.
It is cool.
Yeah, it is cool. They made a couple of announcements. The first one is they struck a deal with Asus to bundle their Leap Motion controller with their laptops and their all-in-one PCs.
Nice.
So that's going to be very cool. Plus, they were able to raise another round of venture capital worth $30 million.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah, and basically that's going to allow them to advertise, get the word out, and, you know, start making stuff. Which
I can say, $30 million is production money. That's what that is. It's done. Now we need to start making these boxes.
Yeah, and their goal is to start selling them later this year, priced around $70.
It's not terrible. I mean, especially for a first generation version of the system. You know, I would have to have a use case. I'd have to have a use case. But, you know, with Windows 8 and like all the this might be a good time to start moving into this. This is a perfect time. So with Windows 8 and all of their
listening to the Furlow Bros Tech Podcast.
Do you want to give a real one?
Yeah, I could do it. So you're listening to the Furlow Bros Tech Podcast.
Cool. So this brings us into a really good segue into our next segment. Wow, that's
this is gonna be a fun
awkward
experiment.
I'm gonna say. Some people like to do this like before the show. We why?
Part of the fun of it.
We'll just edit this out. I'll add in post.
I won't.
See, the joke is that they'll listen to me say that. I think what that actually could be really cool with is this whole idea of Windows 8, because I've been watching. It's actually kind of fun to like go on tech blogs and stuff and watch their Windows 8 review and just have reviews and just have basically people make these like 10-30 minute videos where they just whine and complain for 30 minutes about how awful Windows 8 is and all the little things. And they've got little compliments here and there. Like, actually, this isn't so bad. This is pretty nice. I guess this is pretty good. And then they'll just be like, why is this his way? And one of the big things that everybody complains about, especially with the Metro, is that it's just horrible with the mouse or even worse with a trackpad because it's just There are little bad. Things. Yeah, there are little things that it's not designed. It does not work well with it. It's really bad. And so it would be kind of cool if, you know, Leap comes out with this, you know, they start selling these sensor bars, and I could really see how that could help, that could help companies along, consumers along, because now it's like, you're in your normal, like, mode with what's it called, with, like, in the desktop mode, and okay, now we're switching over to the Metro mode. Yeah, and you've got your little Leap thing, like, right next to your keyboard, and so you can just start going into, I could see that. I that could be useful, but, hopefully, that's cool. I like them, and it's not just because I have friends that work there, but because they're actually, it's cool technology.
So let's talk about Windows 8. There are no official figures, from what I understand.
Yes.
But there's this general sense, and, what I would call secondary, it's not secondary research technically, but hearsay research.
They're not necessarily, I would say there's no official numbers, but there's unofficial numbers that people have been compiling using different metrics, so
right.
It's, it's not unfair to say we kind of know how it's going.
So the big question is why?
We'll start with the headline,
okay.
Which is Windows 8 is seriously less popular than Vista.
Vista?
Some would argue that the way that is measured is unfair. So, like, full disclosure, basically these guys are going, like, they're just not selling as many Windows 8 as they did Vista. The uptake is way slower. And a lot of people are saying you got to look at it as a percentage of the number of computers being sold. You got to look at it as a percentage of the number of computers that are out there. Windows 8, although it is the new operating system, it's part of a larger ecosystem of Windows computers. So it's like, it's not necessarily, it doesn't really threaten the Windows hegemony so much as it's, there's a lot of different angles to it, but it is notable in that people want Windows 8 less than they want Vista, and people did not want Vista. So nice job, Windows.
We all knew this was coming, right?
Right. Yeah, somebody predicted this at the beginning of last year, and is being proven completely right, which is to say, it's a better, it's a better core, but people don't like it.
How crazy is that to be working for a company, a mega corporation, where you know about this trend, and yet, for whatever reason, you can't seem to fix it?
What do you mean?
Well, they know that every other operating system tends to be not well received, and, it's just too rough around the edges. They know it. It's happened multiple times. You know that they read all the other comments and the stuff that we did. And yet it still happened anyways. It's so weird. You know it, and yet you can't do anything about it. That just says something about, momentum and direction and just how hard it is to change some of those things. It's just weird. That's all.
Yeah.
Well,
it's an interesting question. I always made the joke of it was like they were doing it on purpose because they would basically get so Vista was so early, it started with ME really. It was so 2000 and ME, it was so bad that it galvanized people to get XP, and they ran out as soon as it was there. Oh, thank, finally we have something that's decent. And it took a while for XP to get stable and nice, but once it was up and running, everybody loved it. And then they come out with Vista, and people hate it. And then, finally they, galvanize themselves and move forward. And, now when 7 comes out, people, are going for it, which is like, it's almost like they do it on purpose, except this is going to cost Ballmer his job. So I'm sure he's not actually doing this one on purpose, but...
I was reading something else that was they were trying to explain it above and beyond what we just said, right? Which is really, okay. That's just a pattern. We don't know anything behind it. It's weird. But what they were saying is that netbooks are actually the ones to blame for this.
That's really.
Yeah, it was an interesting article by Paul Thurrott that was explaining Windows 8 PC sales over the holidays. And his little subtitle is, "It's time to stop denying that Windows 8 is off to a slow start." And he has one, I mean, he says a lot, but I thought there was one paragraph in there that just kind of, he could have just put that one paragraph and called it a day, and I think it would have been just as good of an article.
Yeah.
Where basically what he says is that it's not pat to say that the Windows PC market went for volume over quality. I think most of us can agree with that. Because it did. And many of the 20 million Windows 7 licenses each month, he goes, too many, he thinks, went to machines that are basically throwaway plastic pieces of garbage. Netbooks didn't just rejuvenate the market just as much as Windows... is that right? Yeah, netbooks didn't just rejuvenate the market just as Windows 7 appeared. They also destroyed it from within. And here's the key line. Now consumers expect to pay next to nothing for a Windows PC. Most of them simply refuse to pay for a more expensive Windows PC.
Right.
So you have this problem where, yeah, netbooks came along and they were cheap, razor-thin margins. Come to find out you can't make any money selling netbooks, even if you call them, what did HP call them, mini PCs? It was the HP Mini. Which, you know, is a don't call it a netbook. That looks like a netbook thing. And, which was cool, whatever. But they couldn't make any money off it. So HP stopped, and consumers were like, all right, PCs are cheap. Yay, it's awesome. And now you come out with Windows 8 that is a little bit different, a little weird, can't necessarily run it on a netbook. Maybe you can, or it just doesn't run well because that touchscreen piece of it is there. So you had a situation where it requires a more advanced computer, a more expensive computer to do it. People or manufacturers are starting to pull out from netbooks, which I think you had an article there that said actually...
Wait. Yeah, what I was going to say... Sorry, I had to sneeze. So what I was going to say is... So I did have this Business Insider article, which is like... directly counterintuitive to this whole thing, which is basically Asus and a couple of Asus, who is the biggest manufacturer of netbooks, and a couple of the other supporting ones are no longer going to make them.
Did you ever play with an Asus netbook?
I
felt like I was going to break it. Oh my gosh! And the keyboards were, that was just an exercise in frustration using that machine.
Right.
Other than the price tag, I don't know why you would buy one.
And they're super underpowered. That's the biggest problem that I always had, is that they couldn't run. So to me, I was having an interesting conversation with Keegan Black, a guest host of the Furlow Bros Tech podcast. I was actually talking to him on Saturday, and I started to say this out loud, and I was like, "Oh, I got to remember this for the podcast." and because basically what my argument was, I think that the netbook thing had as much to do with price as it did with XP, and this problem that Windows had, because there was this time early on in the netbook, you know, environment where manufacturers, because they were so small and inexpensive, pretty much the only way to get them on the shelves is to make them really underpowered. They have old CPUs, they have tiny amounts of RAM, they have tiny hard drives. And so to compensate, basically they were taking what was it, like essentially like 3-4 year old technology, put it into this tiny package, and so they put a 5 to 10 year old operating system on it, and the operating system ran great because XP could run on it. And so what you do is you buy this tiny little computer, you could take it with you anywhere, the battery lasted a decent amount of time, but you take it home, you put it on your desk, you plug it into your 24-inch monitor, you get your wireless keyboard and mouse, you plug it into a wall socket, and you've got a full-powered XP machine. And the nice part about XP is because it was designed for XP was designed for this type of hardware, and all the software that runs on XP was designed for this type of hardware. It actually worked great. All the internet browsers worked on it the way it was supposed to. Everything was, it was snappy, they were quick, they were pretty good systems. You just had to have XP. The problem is that they were already on a Windows 7 by the time, like, they were taking care of this problem. And I think, and what my, what I, one of the things that I think really drove it for a while was that was really your only option to a large degree to get XP was to go with a netbook. And I think there were a lot of people, and that one of the things that, like, I've had to reshift my focus on and how I understand consumer sentiment, because this isn't me at all. Like, this is very foreign to me, this idea of sticking with XP because it works and it's got everything you like. But the thing is that, to me, it's like I want to move to the next operating system. I'm actually anxious for the service packs to come out so that Windows 8 gets to a place where it's stable, it's good, it works, and it's a relatively cheap update, which is what they keep aiming for. I'm hoping to update to 8 in mid to end of this year, because I'm hoping that they get to the point where they take care of all these little things with an update, and people go, it's a good operating system now. Because to me, I keep saying, and I really do believe this, that the core of the system, running .NET, running, you know, where everything is really designed around this new concept, this is where Windows is going. It's a good operating system from that perspective. It's interface issues that they're really running into, which can be changed. Those aren't fundamental flaws. Those are just really, really stupid mistakes. And so I sit there and I go, to me, my disposition is to do that. Whereas I'm spending a lot of time with people who, like, they still want to use XP. They do everything they can to get their programs, their life, their comfort level is XP. And so if you throw Windows 7 at them, they're like, you're sitting there going, it's the same stupid operating system. It just looks prettier and it runs better. Like, what are you having troubles with? But people have serious difficulties with it, and because it's unfamiliar. And I've always argued that, you know, there is good operating systems are intuitive, but I still think that most people deal with familiarity most. They like what's familiar, and if they say it's not intuitive, what they're actually saying is, I'm not familiar. And I think that a lot of people were buying netbooks because it was familiar, because it ran XP. And I think that there's a real correlation between when they finally put the hammer down and said, we're not going to allow you to load them up with XP anymore, and the, you know, precipitous drop in netbook sales. There's a little bit of a lag there, because I don't think people really understood. You know, the market moves slowly, you know, takes months and sometimes years to react to that sort of mentality shift where, oh, if I need to get a netbook, I can just get a netbook and it'll be familiar. But I think consumers figured that out. And so netbook sales are, like, falling off the map, and nobody can make any money off of them. They're completely, you know, zero margin. Like, nobody's happy with netbooks. And so so this kind of goes into this bigger argument of, and this is all leading up to a crescendo. So get excited, people. Because what's going on here is, I think it's part of a bigger trend. We keep trying to explain away Windows 8's problems as their specific UI problems or their familiarity issues,
or the PCs that are running it are more expensive than what people are willing to pay because of previous conditioning.
Right, and all of these things are true. I completely believe that. There's no denying that if you could fix these, sales would be better.
All right, fanboys, spit it out. What's the reason?
I'm gonna say, but they're all under this bigger trend of MacBook sales fell 6% this year over year. They didn't sell as many MacBooks, and people still love Apple MacBooks. There's no rational explanation for it except one product.
Here it comes.
And that's the iPad Mini. It's stupid.
The Mini or the iPad?
I think it's the Mini. I think it's the Mini. The Mini was the price point that everybody wanted. And what it is, and what I should say is, it's actually completely unfair and not really true to say it's the iPad Mini, to put it onto any particular product. Because what it is it's the iPhones. It's the Samsung Galaxy S. It's the Nexus 4. It's the Kindle Fire. It's the iPad. It's the iPad Mini. It is
The tablet.
Us moving from an agrarian culture who uses trucks to a business centralized city who use sedans. That analogy that Steve Jobs gave years ago when they introduced the iPad, that everybody was like, people used to use desktops. That's clearly ending. That paradigm is ending, and it's like desktops.
IMac, don't listen to him, okay? He doesn't mean it. I love you so much. You're not going anywhere for at least a year.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's funny. It's like our parents, their computer completely crashed, right?
And, did it finally completely crash?
Well, we think the graphics card died on it. We still got to get data off of it. But it's like, I sit there and I go, you know, there was discussions of replacing it, and it hasn't been it has not been turned on, and hasn't functioned for 3 months. And you want to know how much our parents have noticed? None. They haven't noticed any at
That's
all.
That's amazing.
I mean, yeah, because they both have iPads. They spend 90% of their time on that.
And laptops for those few times they need to type something or watch a Flash video.
Exactly. They have work laptops that they use very, very occasionally. Interesting. I see them turn on once a week. And, you know, and there is definitely a place for the laptop and the desktop. I'm not saying that they're ever going to go away. There's still trucks. There's still dump trucks. But they're not the entirety
Max,
of the economy.
See, there's a place for you.
Exactly.
Right here on my desk.
Yeah, don't worry about it. But the thing is that what you're seeing is this trend. And to me, I just like anybody who doesn't see this as all of those, you know, when we talk about like the idea of how do you support up an idea, you come up with you have different pillars that all hold up an idea. And some
yes,
pillars
an
are
amazing
small,
book, Psychology of Persuasion. I highly recommend everybody read it.
And yes, yeah, that I didn't read it, but I've held on to this. I actually really should because I use this example.
It will blow your
all the
mind.
Time.
It's probably one of the best books I've ever read.
So it's like it's this idea that you have all these different pillars that support up your different arguments, and the thing is that there's usually one core one, and you can take it away, and all of these supporting ones are still there to kind of hold it up. So I'm going to use this analogy for our argument for what's going on here. The primary pillar is we don't want laptops and desktops anymore. And a lot of fanboys are screaming at it going, I hate this. What are you talking about? I'm like, but look at the general consumer. When Vista came out, Apple had tons of those commercials that were basically like, look, you now have to learn a new operating system. Why not jump across the lake? Why not come over to this side of the fun yard? The grass is actually greener and learn OS X. And they did get quite a bit of traffic.
They're not
over.
Even saying OS X. They're saying, why not learn iOS?
Well, but that was the thing, is that was literally the commercials that they were running were literally for OS X.
Okay.
Now, and I think they missed
the boat, I see what you're
too.
Saying.
And it just happened to be that they had iOS at the time. But that's what's happened. People finally were forced to learn something other than XP. And so they're trying different stuff. They're learning different stuff. Why should I learn Windows when my iPhone works just as well? Or when, you know, and
my Android device.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I'm familiar with these things, so I'll stick with them because they're familiar. And so all of a sudden, Windows 8 is the least familiar of all of them. And it's not, you know, what are tablets? They're cheap. It doesn't matter where you're looking at. I mean, even the iPad is cheap compared to all of these other, you know, an iPad is an expensive netbook. And the iPad Mini is a netbook. And, you know, Windows or all of your different Nexus tablets, they're all competing on this super low price point. And then, you know, and the advent of the subsidized smartphone has really just changed this to the point where you don't need a laptop. You don't need a desktop. Or you very rarely need them. You don't need to replace them as often. And what you're seeing is the beginning of the end of this movement, which is what the whole point of Windows 8 was, right? I mean, it was they realized that everything was going mobile. And so they made this difficult transition for them, which was to move towards a mobile operating system. And it appears that they, you know, fumbled it in basically every UI way that they could have.
No compromises. Where when they should have just had two operating systems. And
right, and they should have just, yeah, made all the compromises. And but, you know, whatever. It's their money, not mine. Yeah. But the thing is it's like people talk about the fact that people don't, you know, why would I upgrade my perfectly good Windows 7 machine up to Windows 8? You're like, that is a great question. Why would you do that? Yeah. Well, I think you're going to start to see the trend of people holding onto their laptops longer and longer, and people are going to blame the economy, or blame this, or blame that, or blame whatever. But the truth is that you don't need it for as much. It doesn't need to perform as well. They last longer. Like, we don't think of computers as machines that wear out, but they do. Transistors burn out. You know, fans burn out. Things don't work as well. Your battery life decreases. So if you don't use the device as much, if you don't use it as often, the thing stays fresher, it stays newer, and it performs better for a longer period of time.
And you're not loading all sorts of stuff on it because
exactly
you're using a different device for those types of activities. You know, you're downloading apps now instead of Flash things and who knows what's else in the background, like so many of us do. So, totally off topic.
Okay,
I was at a friend's house watching the Vikings-Packers game, which was supposed to be a really good game up until I learned that the Vikings had starting quarterback was hurt. Then you were oh, this isn't going to be a fun game to watch anymore.
And it wasn't.
So anyways, so we were there and we were talking, and he bought his wife an iPad mini for Christmas. And so I was playing around with it a bit. Man, I'll be honest, that device is pretty sweet. But I still find myself like, what is the difference between the iPad and the iPad mini besides size? Because to me, it's like you don't get any extra storage. You don't run any extra apps. You get a bigger screen, right? I mean, and it's heavier. So you got to decide, okay, big screen versus heavier. How do I choose? So here's my wish list. I really hope that Apple helps me make a choice by actually differentiating them a little bit more than just size.
No, they're going to do what's even worse. They're both going to have the exact same resolution.
It's going to be crazy. But anyways, I'm just...
What's your wish list?
I would like them to somehow differentiate them in such a way that it makes my decision easier.
Like what?
Give me more storage in the bigger one. Or allow me to run multiple apps at the same time. Something like that.
Okay, I see what you're saying. Yeah, you know, I could see that. That would be pretty... Oh, yeah, I could see that. I could see
them
doing...
just somehow for me to... Because, you know, when they came out with the iPod Touch versus the iPod Classic versus the Nano, you know, they function very differently and have different sizes and uses. They're not just different sizes, or you know what
I mean? Right. They're not just bigger, smaller screens. They're actually... they perform different tasks. They're designed for different things.
Of course, I suppose with their MacBook and iMac line, they do just make different size computers. So perhaps that's all it is.
Yeah, and I think to a large degree that's exactly what it is. Is it's, you know, and I think you might see different.
Of course, with that one, it at least before they came out with a MacBook Pro with Retina display and a name that's really long, I felt, you know, at least the Air was a little differentiated. Oh, there's no drive and it's super thin and blah, blah, blah.
But most consumers are buying based on two things: familiarity and price. And you know, what is the iPad Mini except a cheaper version of a very familiar, comfortable device, or a little bit more expensive version and a little bit bigger than a very comfortable device in the iPhone. I mean, it's a perfect upgrade or downgrade. And the thing is, you know, I come back to, it's like, to me, I've said it on the show a bunch, but the iPad Mini is the right size. I don't understand why you get the full size iPad. I really don't, because it's too big. Why do you need something that big? The iPad Mini is the right size.
Because your wife wants to draw pictures on it. And
okay. Well, you know, there's some size. There are some use cases where you might be able to justify that, you know, brick, that behemoth of a device, which is hilarious because I can't believe how powerful Steve Jobs' distortion field was. I wanted to believe. He told me that a seven inch, you know, tablet was too small and didn't make any sense.
7.9.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. That's the difference. That's the difference right there. You know, he told me that it was too big of a, it was too small of a device. If you were to get that small, it only made sense the 10 inch. And you pick one up, you know, where all they did was scale the buttons down, and you're like, what?
They did exactly what? Perfect. Yeah. Which makes you wonder, just like, did he know that? Or
yes, he did. We've seen him do that enough where he would just like, people don't read anymore. And then a year later came out with iBooks so you could read. I mean, he did that stuff all the time. And I think it's so funny that like, man, I can't believe how much I bought into that. And the moment I picked it up, I was like, obviously this is the right way. The only reason they didn't make it this size in the first place is because they couldn't fit all the technology into it. It was too small of a body, so they went with the bigger body because it was easier. But this is clearly nice. So
let me recap your thesis here to make sure I understand it, and let me oversimplify it perhaps a little bit. So Windows 8 is not selling well for a variety of reasons. Some smaller side reasons are the netbooks aren't doing as well, and so in the sense that they're cheaper computers, and in order to run Windows 8, it requires a better computer, and consumers are not exactly willing or are no longer trained to buy more expensive computers. But also, as a general trend, Windows 8 itself is confusing and hard to figure out, and so people are apprehensive because it is learning something new. But the bigger, more important reason is that people are migrating over to this new touch tablet, very simple experience, because they're like, if I have to learn something new, let's at least make it simple. And right. Tablets, and specifically the iPad, are fulfilling that need.
Does that sound about right? Yeah. The only thing I would add is this interesting trend of it's not intentional at all. It already happened.
Right.
And we're just seeing the consequences of what already happened, which was people using Android and iPhone and learning those systems, mm-hmm. and having those be sufficient for their internet browsing and their productivity. And you're only seeing the exaggeration of that in the iPads and the tablets.
Makes sense.
Yeah. It's a new world, man. It's happening. I am excited.
Very excited. Well, everybody, you're listening to the Frilla Bros Tech Podcast. And what I want to know is, what was the top-selling item on Amazon over the holiday?
Well, so the top-selling item, I don't actually know. But the top-selling laptop, there we go, was not an Asus, was not a MacBook, which is not surprising at all, since they get
not an HP laptop.
Yeah, if it wasn't an HP laptop, wasn't anything. It wasn't Windows. It wasn't a Windows laptop. It wasn't a Linux laptop. It was the Chromebook.
Holy cow.
The best selling laptop on Amazon.
I do not understand that at all.
I don't get it either.
Did they buy it by accident because they could touch it and feel it? And they're this is a real cheap computer.
You know what's going to be – honestly, you know what I think happened was Chrome has gotten a tremendous amount of market penetration. It is a very familiar interface, and they're stupid cheap. They're laptops. They're cheap laptops. They are the netbooks. That's
the
what
netbooks.
And what's so funny about this is, like, I'm about to basically go back on everything that I said. Well, not really, because this kind of actually, I meant to include this in the last conversation, because this sort of feeds into this larger attitude of this transition away from, people are willing to not buy Windows devices. They're trying to learn something new, so they're looking for what's already familiar. Well, people have figured out Chrome. They like Chrome, and they basically sit down and go, you mean it's just a big Chrome thing? Well, I don't really do anything. That's pretty much all I do all day, so that's pretty nice. And like, how much does it cost? It costs $200, $300. Holy cow, it's a full laptop. That's awesome. Yeah, I'll do that. And I think what happened was, you know, they didn't sell very many. They sold a lot, obviously. But But the whole laptop market is very depressed this year. So it's not like they saved the market. What they did was they basically swooped on the Windows 8 market. They came in and, you know, took sales that should have been going to HP or Asus or, you know, one of your other competitors in that from Microsoft's perspective. But I still don't get why people are buying them.
I have a funny feeling return rates are kind of high on that one. But I don't know. I mean, buying a computer online, fine. You know, I've bought a lot of computers online. But I went to the store and played with them and knew exactly what I was getting. And I just feel people either were confusing it for Windows 8 or for a regular laptop. I don't know.
I think there's a lot of interest.
Maybe it's legit, and people are like, oh yeah, this is Chrome. I've been wanting to get this browser only thing. Yeah, it's got Wi-Fi built in. Awesome. Yeah, or not Wi-Fi, but 3G.
I have a friend who works for Best Buy. This is hyper anecdotal. I mean, this
okay,
is
okay. I love those type. Let's make it fact.
But his experience with his coworkers is that they're basically not even trying to push Windows 8. They're like, don't go Windows 8. It's pretty bad.
Ah.
And which really only leaves you the Chromebook and the and Microsoft. Apple, you know, OS X. And so what you're seeing is a lot of the tech advisors of the world, your salespeople out there, and I get the sense that this is true across the market, are advocating for, you don't really need Windows 8. Don't you just need a web browser? Go with this. You know, and so Windows 8 is selling like crazy because, you know, it's Windows 8 and people need, you know, people are going to buy Windows or not. But if there was a market of people who were, you know, persuadable where they could be pushed one way or another, well, you know, a Mac is super expensive. I can't do that. I can't really get a very cheap Windows, but I can get this really kind of powerful, cheap Chromebook that, and all I really want to do is check emails and go online and do some stuff. Well, yeah, sure, I'll go with that. And I think people are being sold on that bill of goods. I have a feeling that it isn't. My sense is that it actually is not as much people confused or thinking they're buying Windows 8 or not really knowing what they're getting into, so much as they're taking the advice of this legion of tech advisors that are telling you, no, go with Chromebook. They're pretty nice. I mean, and one of the things for me, I've had people ask me what my opinion of the Chromebook was, and I always say it's a quarter of an operating system. I mean, if you want to do anything else, it's difficult. If you know that that's all you're going to do, it's great. But if you suspect that you might do anything more, you might want to consider something else. And
I will admit that mine has done nothing but collect dust for like the last 6 months.
Yours is also a very underpowered version of what they're selling nowadays.
True, which makes it not super fun to use.
Right, exactly. Nowadays, they're actually what they realized, and what Google realized, is that they need to have a certain amount of, you know, agility and ability, and so they're putting more RAM in it, they're putting better chips in it, there's a little bit of hard drive space. They really have tried to turn they're actually decent pieces of hardware, and that has made a big difference. Is they're not the pathetic little, you know, turtles of. Two or three years ago, they're
not the netbooks anymore.
They're actually decent computers. They just happen to run a different operating system, which has made a big difference for them.
Hey, cool, good for them. So there's been another company that's are moving away from. I don't know how do I want this transition to work. Oh, I don't know. So tell me what's up with Samsung.
So Samsung is making oodles and oodles of money because, you know, they were the number one for an entire quarter. But they are by far and long the best-selling Android phone out there. So they love Android because they're making oodles and oodles of money on hardware, and they don't have to pay for any of the software. or the development fees are very low because they put all their own proprietary stuff on it, which is garbage. It's absolute garbage, and I it's the reason why I couldn't stick with the it's not the only reason, but it's one of the big reasons I couldn't hang with the Samsung Galaxy S is because of their proprietary stuff that they put on top of it that I wasn't willing to fight to get rid of. So they're doing great, and everybody's like, wow, this is a match made in heaven. Well, Samsung confirmed this last week that they're going to be trying to move away from Android. Everybody's like, excuse me? You're making tons of money off of this. Why would you do that? And Samsung's concern is, and they see the same news that we see. They don't have any special insider knowledge. But what they see is the fact that Google is making all of their money. They're still a one-trick pony. They make the vast majority of their money off of Google search results.
Dude, reading an article about that, and they're like, oh no, Google has like three revenue streams now. Get this. First one, by far and away, search revenue.
Right.
AdWords. Like, the second one are banner ads inside of YouTube. Which is like, okay, cool. Then the third one is Android. Which, get this, they go, which is actually primarily search ads from Android phones.
Right.
Which I was like,
exactly.
That does not sound like three. That sounds like two. But okay.
Right. YouTube is its own service. But YouTube, I mean, YouTube couldn't exist without the support of the search results. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Well, but, it might be self-sustaining now from a business unit. You know.
Yeah, but it's.
But I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, in the sense that the ads might be enough to pay for all their server costs for the billions of minutes of, you know, video people are uploading. Maybe. Yeah. I don't know.
What I was going to say was, I think, so basically what's going on is Samsung sees this fact that Google really, really wants to diversify because they realize they're trying to figure out how to make money and, you know, doing what they do and how do they stick around. And, you know, what's the trend that we saw over the last, year or couple years? Well, the big one is Microsoft doing the Surface. Why did Microsoft do Surface? Because it's really profitable. When you do that and you compete against your OEMs, you don't have to pay for your operating system.
Right.
You build the hardware, you make all the profit. Why did Microsoft do that? Well, that's because that's what Apple does, and they're the highest market cap company in the world. They're worth oodles and oodles of money. They might not be right now, but they are worth crazy money. They make tremendous profits because they make hardware. Samsung is making a lot of money off of Android. They're doing very well because, guess what? They're making hardware. Well, now now Google owns Motorola Mobility. They work closely with HTC for the Nexus. They have their own pieces of hardware. It is just a matter of time, really and truly, before Google decides that there is a serious potential revenue stream from hardware. And this is all getting kind of gearing up for the whole Google Glasses thing. I think what Samsung is seeing is that there are no other Android competitors that can really take them down except Google. Because Google, all they have to do is start charging for the operating system.
And Google's not going to do that, but what they're going to do is they're going to give themselves special access to other features.
Right. It's like Apple. They get
the glasses.
They get the inside area API. Why are all the Apple apps better than everything else? Well, it's because they use their own internal API, except the podcast.
Well, I mean, I don't know. They might do something. I don't feel like Google would do this, but other than say, hey, we've been working on this Google Glasses, and we built some stuff that allows you to interact, or they'll give themselves access to it first. They'll build out cool features for Android, build the phones that work with it, and then when they release the phones and release the operating system, then Samsung goes, oh, cool, now we got to spend a couple months to make this phone while Google soaks up all the sales and is constantly ahead. I could see something like that, but I feel like Google's going to – they're not going to charge and they're not going to be all proprietary about it because they are a genuinely open company. I think they'll just give themselves first crack at it And now that they have a hardware company to do that with, you know, they'll legitimately do that as opposed to working with a specific partner to create the Nexus phones.
Right, and I agree with you. I agree with that assessment. But the point was, and the larger point is, Samsung's fear is Google. They realize that pretty soon here, if Google wants to make serious money off of Android, they're going to do it in hardware, and they're going to do it by, at least to some degree, unfairly competing against Samsung. And so their choice is either to get jerked around by Google and just put up with it as long as they can, or to do something else. And it turns out that they bought MeeGo, which was Nokia's operating system that everybody was all excited about before they completely abandoned it and went with Windows 8. And there's a lot of debate about, I guess, I've been reading articles where basically people were saying, like, there were people within the company that tanked that project because they really wanted to move over to Windows Phone. And it was malicious and insider, which I think is stupid. I think MeeGo just wasn't as good of an operating system, and nobody was really, you know, it didn't have any development on it yet. It wasn't Android, and it wasn't Windows Phone, and so it just kind of went by the wayside. Nokia couldn't really get a handle on it. Well, Samsung's got tons of money, so they bought it, and they turned it into this new thing called, like, I think it's called Tizen? T-I-Z-E-N. Tizen. So basically, what they're going to... Zen, yeah.
I don't know.
Actually, it might be how you say it. I don't know. Doesn't matter. The point is that they're basically redeveloping MeeGo into their own proprietary software operating system, and they plan to start launching phones with it. And at least, you know, and there's questions about what that will look like. Will they have, you know, completely non-Android phones that they're selling? Where are they going to sell it? It looks like they're only going to sell it in Japan at first. That, you know, they're doing a couple of different things that they're working on that are specifically to help them move away from Android, to help them, you know, hopefully sell tons and tons of phones outside of the Android market. And it's all in preparation for the day that Google finally decides to drop the hammer and, you know, make some real money. And you know, because when we were talking about this just a few weeks back, talking about what would Google have to do if all of a sudden their ad revenue through Google search went away, and you know, I think that this, you know, we talked about them licensing it and, you know, Android and having people pay, you know, and you know, charging for the operating system, but I think clearly Apple and Microsoft are kind of proving that, you know, going the hardware route. Well, and Samsung themselves is proving going the hardware route can really pay for these operating system costs, you know, things that you basically give away for free. So, you know, because the reality of it is, Apple gives away iOS for free. You know,
right.
So, clearly, it's a business model that works, but they're freaking their partners out pretty good.
Yeah, I still think it's going to be something that is going to take years to play out. I don't think we'll see anything immediately per se.
Well, I could see Google making a big announcement early 2014. You know, CES come out with a serious phone competitor with a big manufacturing backbone and a big distribution backbone, saying we're entering the market, and you know, a fully Google branded phone. You know, brought to you by, you know, our Motorola. I could see that. And I could see it not be branded as a Nexus phone also. I don't know. That's an interesting question. There's such a weird company in how they do that sort of thing where it's like the Nexus department competes against the Motorola department. they're not actually. So, you know, they might have, you know, I don't know. But I guess my point is that, you know, I think, yeah, it'll take years for this all to play out, but it clearly Samsung thinks it's going to be happening soon enough where it's time to pull the trigger and, you know, try to move beyond this really profitable thing that they got going on.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. All right. Fair enough. Mm. Interesting. Huh. Debating on whether or not I want to say it or not.
Go for it.
Do you think I should?
Do it, yes.
You're listening to the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast.
Nice.
And what I want to talk about next is why Silicon Valley innovation has stalled. Okay. There was this article by Pando Daily, and it had a lot of the sentiment that I talked about.
Panda Daily?
Pando Daily.
Pando, okay. Because I was going to say, is this a website with, like, panda pictures? what are you looking at?
Yeah. Nope.
This is a job, James.
It's pretty much it's TechCrunch 2.0.
That's
how I would describe it. So it started off with this one guy, Peter Thiel, lamented that they promised us flying cars, but instead we got 140 characters. And another guy, Michael Arrington, who was the founder of TechCrunch, he complained that he's bored with innovation. And which was a similar sentiment to what I gave on last week's. And I was like, I don't see anything cool happening in 2013.
Yeah. The big Apple rumor right now, by the way, is they're going to come out with a radio.
A radio? Oh, yeah, baby. I did see that.
That was the hot one this week, which I was just like, that's so stupid. If Apple does that, if people are buying into it, that's just, no.
I read one today, this afternoon. It was awesome. I don't know if you saw it yet, but this guy was like, Apple's really been struggling lately, which is evidenced by their stock price. And what they really need to do.
Stock price means anything.
Yeah, well, they're like, what they really need to do is they need to prove their innovation. And he was like, basically, the iPhone 5 was nothing but just a small refresh from the 4S. And so here's what Apple needs to do. They need to stop with the iPhone 6. Just like stop making iPhones altogether and focus their attention on some real innovation in the TV space.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, I was like, because the TV hasn't been done before.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's your answer. Prove your innovation by stop making your best-selling product. Great idea. Yeah. That'll really prove something to Wall Street.
Yeah, you're awesome. One company has done that, and it worked really, really great for them. And that was Sony back in the day. They stopped making radios because they realized what was going to happen was radios were going to go away, and so they basically just dropped anchor. But it was rough. It was horrible for a while because they didn't sell their best-selling product anymore. it's just a dumb idea. But the thing is, jeez. Didn't he listen to Tim Cook? This is their most innovative year. They launched 37 new products in the last quarter. Completely different line than they had 6 months
totally
ago.
Totally different. Yeah, I love reading articles like that where Apple needs to prove its innovation by making a TV and a wristwatch and a radio. Yeah. I love it. We'll put a little eye in front and that makes it innovative.
Right.
Come on, guys. Come on. Yeah.
Which, you can legitimately make those innovations. I'm not saying that you can't be innovative in those space, but it is pretty funny when, like, this is basically what you're doing is you're writing an article that you think will get clicks. I clicked on it, and I'm sorry for it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's to claim that that's innovation and what they're doing with the iPhone is not.
Right.
That's the part that just, you're like, really? Okay. Anyways. So the point of that little diatribe was in this article, these two high profile guys were like, yeah, we're just bored. There's no real innovation going on in general, which I would agree that, there's a lot of innovation going on in the social space, perhaps, less so in the high extreme technological space. I don't know how to describe it. But what line that this person had, he goes, people who are not working at the, so he goes on to say real innovation happens from people who are experts and at the forefront of their field. He goes, the people working for SpaceX, those engineers are at the forefront of space flight. And so they're coming up with true innovations. And the only way you can come up with a true innovation is, again, to kind of already know of everything that already exists. Makes right. sense. Because if you don't, you just don't have an appreciation. You don't have an understanding of the complexities and, quite frankly, what counts as a step forward. And so what he says is that people who are not working at the forefront of their technology, they're still trying to be innovators. Okay. But he used some medical research analogy. And so he's like, but he goes, basically the current internet space is largely driven by people trying to make a fast buck as opposed to people working at the edge of the envelope. And really what he's saying is these are not people who are experts in internet technologies and microprocessor technology and computer technology. These are people who they're social experts and innovating on the social front. And right. That is starting, it's kind of like, all right, guys, we did a lot there. Twitter was awesome. Facebook's pretty cool. Let's move on to the next thing. But there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of expertise or movement. I'm not saying that right. It exists, but that bucket of people is very small. And there are still a significant number of people who want to start up companies and, you know, create businesses. And they call themselves innovators. Which they are, like you were talking about. You can make innovations with the radio and the iWatch.
I'll tell you what's different. Wrong. Can I interject here?
No, but I'll let you anyways.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'll tell you what they're bummed about. They are finally mourning Steve Jobs' death. A man who could make simple iterative improvements seem like he is completely undone the fabric of reality.
Okay, so I'm not talking specifically about Apple. I mean, they're just talking in general.
No. I know. And what I'm saying is that Apple, that Steve Jobs had this like mysticism over the entire market, because I mean, it started with the personal computer. Personal computers existed. I mean, like they were there. You know, hobbyists were doing it. People were excited. What did Steve Jobs bring to the table with the Apple, with the Mac? What did he do? He basically created this product that copied other products. They did it a little bit different. They did it very tight. It was a good package. It was a good piece of equipment, but it wasn't necessarily innovative. The difference is that Steve Jobs made you believe you needed a GUI-based personal computer. And what happened was even though people didn't necessarily go out and buy the Mac, what they wanted now was a GUI-based personal computer. Steve Jobs introduces the iPad. He doesn't just launch the iPad. He launches the tablet. You know, and he had this. He was such a showman, and he was so brilliant about how he did this, where he was really able to make you feel like he was changing the world by bringing you this touch panel with a small processor in it. I mean, it's like it's crazy what he was able to do with as little that, you know, I guess what I'm trying to say is that, you know, a very hypercritical view of everything that Steve Jobs did, where his biggest quote-unquote innovations, they weren't very innovative, which is why people get so angry when Steve Jobs gets credit for being this great innovator. So the question that I always have, and we talk about this, is it's like, what's really the difference between a big step in innovation versus an iterative improvement? And I always argue they're the same thing, they're just a difference in degrees. And at some point, when you get a big enough difference in degree, you get a difference in kind. They're actually different things. And so one of those is an iterative improvement, and one of those is an innovation. And, you know, and when we make innovations, quote-unquote, it's when you have these really big changes of degrees over a short period of time. Mm-hmm. You know, the iPhone 5 is crazy innovative compared to an original iPhone, but because it took 6 years to get there, nobody's impressed. You know, or 5 years, I suppose. So I guess what I'm getting here is it drives me nuts when people say that Facebook isn't really
So they're talking about company. So okay, I get you. They're not talking about the big companies. They're talking about like startups.
Okay.
Which I don't know if that. So the whole paragraph says, "Allow me to draw a larger analogy to the medical field. Virtually all of the scientific advancement in medicine, genetics, pharmaceuticals, and biotech are driven by researchers who are typically PhDs working with the backing of universities or well-funded pharmaceutical companies."
Right.
These are serious scientists who have spent years studying and researching their field. It would be absurd to suggest that people with limited medical or biological education would be expected to create a new cancer drug. True.
Right.
Yet that's the exact scenario we have in the internet space. People who are not working at the forefront of their technology trying to be innovators.
Okay. Okay, so they're basically making the argument. Okay, so I went off on this total tangent.
That's great. Okay. I was trying to see where you were headed with it, and then I went, okay, he's thinking big companies, which I would agree. I mean,
Rich, because that's what he, okay, in my defense, that's what you made it sound like the dude was saying.
Sorry.
Because I would say that Facebook is hugely innovative in their web technologies. Like, they are pioneering different ways to, you know, to all different sorts of technologies, just like Google is, and just like, you know, and just like Twitter is. Like, you know, they're different fields, how they manage different stuff, but it's so much more than social. But yeah, I guess from the perspective of like the little guys, it's definitely got nobody, unless you're working for a big company, nobody's designing the next CPU.
Well, and maybe I was going to say, and maybe the problem is it's a feeling of, to go with this person's analogy, they want a cure for cancer, and it doesn't appear like you have all these new companies that are starting and these bigger companies, and on the surface of it, it doesn't appear like they're working on things like that. Instead, they're working on frictionless sharing.
Right.
You know, and stuff where you go, yeah, that's cool, it's innovative, we're not changing lives per se.
Right.
Saving
when
lives.
The reality of it is, like, what's really impressive about what these companies are doing, it's they build websites that never crash. You know, these massive undertakings. They're improving the structure of the internet to the point where it's so robust that individual, not just the whole system, but individual websites never go down. Which
well,
is,
it's so robust that the number one selling laptop on Amazon is a Chromebook.
Right, exactly. And you sit there, yeah, exactly. That's the point. And, you know, and so, like, yeah, there are huge innovations in these companies, but the little guys, and it's funny, this is to me why, and this, you know, we talked about one of the big predictions that I made this year was the idea that 3D printing is really going to take off, or not necessarily going to take off, but that the Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs of 3D printing are starting to hang out. The guys that are going to be the innovators, that are going to make the first ones, that are going to bring it into the home, they are just getting started doing what they're doing. Because a lot of the fringe hobbyists are finally, that's where they're going. That's what they're getting into. That's what they're working on. And there are no super experts in 3D printing. Everybody's a newbie. Everybody's learning as they go. And so it's very easy to, on your own, be a new innovator in that space. Home automation, you know, believe it or not, like, there's still a ton of openings for home, you know, for that, you know, for being able to do that in the home.
I know, I'm excited about that.
Right. And so it's like, why did we talk, I guess, you know, and maybe that's what we, you know, maybe that's why we brought those two up. Those are our examples of what's the future. It's because newbies, you know, your low, not low education, but your low experience, your non-experts, your non-PhDs can still make big innovations, which means there's millions of people around the world that can make contributions, as opposed to a few thousands of people who can actually design the next CPU core. And because you can, and you were essentially crowdsourcing the next technology. And whereas, because these other technologies, you know, you're really super high tech stuff, they've, you know, like medical devices, they require such a high level of innovation that you can no longer crowdsource those.
Right.
And so they're not nearly as exciting, which to me is why you sit there and you go, you know, why I think that, you know, we're moving away from these. The innovations in the smartphones aren't nearly as fun, and it has everything to do with the fact that the A6 is a system on a chip. There's basically no processors outside of that one piece of silicon, and it's killing companies like the one I work for. Thankfully, we still do stuff that we build circuitry, or one of the primary things that our tools build are diodes, and diodes are used in bigger aspects of circuitry in AC to DC converters and stuff like that. So like, there's still a market for us. But as
just for the record, I love that. Like, I realize that you're being very general and vague with your job because it's generally confusing. But you give a feeling like it's. I can't really tell you much about it. We just make stuff for companies who we can't tell you about.
Yeah.
But it's really just, no, you wouldn't understand it if I used the real words.
Yeah, it's one of those,
I just love it, that's all. Whereas, like, mine is very accessible.
Yeah, exactly. We do, what we do is kind of esoteric, so, yeah, I leave it vague.
I just like it.
Yeah, that is funny, I didn't even realize I was doing that. But
we
what
make
I was gonna
diodes
say is,
for things that are complicated.
Yeah, exactly. But what I was going to say is that there is a huge market. One of the markets that long before I ever got there, we were into was building chips, because it's basically the same process. The part of the process that we do, it's basically the same thing, whether you're making a diode or you're making a logic gate or a full-blown processor. But the thing is that nowadays, because you don't have motherboards are going away that have tons of different discrete chips, you've got one PCB with a few little regulators and stuff on it, and then a single chip that does all of the logic. And that's, and Apple makes that internally, and then they have their own super cool fabs that, you know, manufacture the chips. And you sit there and you go, companies like mine just aren't needed for that sort of manufacturing. And so we're going away because it's all getting hyper-focused. Whereas it's really, you know, whereas these other markets, and these are the fun ones, are where you don't need to be hyper-educated in order and have hyper-focus in order to make innovations. And that's why we come back to, you know, what is Google Goggles? It's a really, you're going to have a couple of PhDs develop this really high-tech piece of hardware, and then, you know, and I read an article that basically Google was talking about the fact that we have no idea what people are going to use Google Goggles for, which the article wrote it as a critique, and I sit there and I go, what? That's beautiful. Steve Jobs had to tell you what the iPad was for, and then most of what people use it for, it's not that. They use it for other things, because what they did was they built a canvas and they let creative people fill it. And that's what Google is doing, is they're building a canvas with this piece of technology. And, you know, and that's why people are legitimately excited about it and want to move forward. And that's where the big innovations are going to be in, I think, in the next, you know, couple of years. It's like, how do you use this new tool to do all these other cool things? That's where you're going to see some serious innovation. People are going to be like, look at this really cool app that uses Google Goggles. And that's where the crowdsourcing, that's where the layman can really get involved and make a big difference. And it's not just, you know, it's not just how do you make a quick buck by, you know, making frictionless sharing as it was, or hipster filters in order to get some money.
Fair enough.
Yeah, okay.
You win. I'll call Uncle. There's innovation happening.
Thank you.
So, dude, what do you want to talk about? Do you know? Here, I got one. Once it loads.
Do you want to? You were listening to the Furlough Bro.
Nah. That's dumb.
Okay, I'll do it.
Okay, yeah, let me hear you say it, man.
You're listening in... Oh, jeez. I hate it with my tongue. I know it didn't sound like I wasn't going to be able to get it out, but if I tried one more syllable, it was going to become obvious that sentence wasn't going to happen. You're listening to the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast. Thanks for staying tuned.
So, care to guess what the top emoticon used in emails was in 2012?
Would you call it an emoticon? Yeah. Not an emoticon?
Correct.
Emoticon. Okay. What was
an emotion icon?
Yeah. Yeah. I always thought I thought it was called an emoticon, but I guess an emoticon actually. I don't know.
I don't know.
I like yours.
There's no rules.
I think
for
I'm
this
gonna stick with yours. You're, seriously, there's no governing body. Have you ever seen those YouTube videos where like you Google how to pronounce it, and it's like this like really legitimate like this is how you pronounce it. They like show the word, they break up the syllables, but they pronounce it completely wrong. It's so funny.
That's awesome.
It was the top emoticon of 2012. I'm going to guess it was a kissy face or winky face. Winky faces seem pretty popular.
You're being too creative. There is a company called Q. Where they do email stuff. And so they get email information on what you use in your emails that you send.
Oh, that's not creepy.
Do you have to sign up
for this service?
Sign up for it. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. I should probably click on the learn more about Q thing. It's QUp.com. They tell me to learn more and then, they do tell me. Da, 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 da. Yeah. Anyways, they review emails. The top emoticon is the smiley face. Just boring old smiley face. But of all the different emoticons used, this one was used 50% of the time.
Wait, what? Which one?
Just the regular smiley face.
Oh, just the regular smiley face?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's totally boring.
I know, but we'll keep going. Guess how many, what the average number of words composed in 2012 was?
Oh, my gosh. Okay.
So this is, take all your emails, add them up, and then divide them by all people.
Wow. Wait. So the number of emails, not the number of words?
No. The number of words.
Per email.
No. Total.
Oh.
So take all the words per email, add all those words up. On average, how many words did we type out in 2012?
Wow. That is a tough one. I'm going to guess 70,000.
You're in the ballpark. 41,000.
You know what actually makes sense?
Go ahead.
For those of you who don't know, the average novel length is between 80 and 120. So
they actually say that it is the equivalent in length of Lord of the Flies.
Right. That's about, I was gonna say, about 150 page novel. That's
so
that
these
ain't bad.
These people are really busy. They received over 5,000 messages and sent 800 messages.
Wow.
In a year. Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is a ratio of about 6.3 to 1. They're receiving versus sending.
That sounds about right for me.
Also, I read this stat somewhere. I don't see it. I'll make it up. Because you won't know any better. The average email reply time last year in 2011 was 2.2 days, but in 2012 was 2.5 days. So it grew a little bit. But I don't see it anywhere on here. But I've heard about it. Is basically what they showed was that like. A lot of the emails, like 50% of them, actually get answered within the hour.
I'm gonna say one deviation on this, not on this beast, because I'm sure it's huge.
Yeah, which means if you don't hear back from someone right away, it might be a while.
Right? Yeah, expect a week.
Yeah, exactly. 11 a.m. is when most people sent their emails, and Tuesday was the best day of the week.
11 a.m. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could see that. Because I'm just finally deciding to get to work by 11 a.m. I'm like, I'm ready to start. I've been here for 3 hours. Okay.
Then, again, probably boring and can be predicted, but do you know the number one animal mentioned in
Dog.
Emails? Yep. Number two?
Oh, yeah. Cat.
Okay, this might be a little harder. Number three?
Giraffe.
Nope.
Okay, bird.
Again, you got to think boring. So bird, was that your legitimate guess?
Yeah, bird's mine.
No, it was fish.
Fish.
Which leaves Horse for number four.
Oh, that's weird.
Yeah.
That wasn't that boring. Birds didn't make it. Well, I guess people don't really own birds.
I guess. I don't know. So anyways, that's Q. I should probably tell you more about what they do. Let's see here. Keep up with your work, life, and daily events you care about. Q turns the accounts you depend on, like email, contacts, and calendar, into an intelligent snapshot of your day. Q surfaces the right details at the right time, so you'll always be one step ahead. So there you go.
Nice.
That's how they know your email.
Nice. So a couple of competitors are having a good time right now. Well, one of them is Amazon and Barnes & Nobles. They have competitive products in a number of categories.
I would put them in the competitor category, I think.
Yeah.
They probably don't like each other a whole lot.
No. And so new data coming out, especially after this Christmas season. Barnes & Nobles is getting whomped. They are not even in the same ballpark. It's difficult to call them competitors at this point. Mm. Amazon is crushing Barnes & Nobles, which is really a bummer because it pretty much was going to be the only reason why Barnes & Nobles would stay around as a brick-and-mortar store. And now bookstores are going to go the way of CD stores, which is to say they won't exist anymore, which is kind of a bummer because I like bookstores, although
so,
an e-reader and don't have books
anymore. Yeah, so Corvallis and Albany, they no longer have the Barnes & Noble, and the Border do not exist anymore. There's still some local bookstores, but that's about it.
That's just not... That can't be good for society.
Well, just download an e-book. That's all good.
Well, I know. I realize that.
Audiobooks. The wave of the future. Get over it.
It still feels wrong. I don't know. I don't know. Does it? I mean, am I completely off base on this one? Because I am going by the gut here. This isn't. There's not a lot.
You
of,
own an e-reader. I don't understand. You're part of the problem.
I know.
So really? I don't understand. What are you off about?
It just feels
feeling bad.
I am different though, because I am not like the rest of people in that, you know, I am a highly educated reader, this is so condescending right now. But I fear for the rest of you all. since you're not like me. I don't know. It's just I actually couldn't put my finger on it if I had to.
Would you feel bad when CDs were going out of style?
Not really, but
like,
it's because,
oh man, those vinyls, man. People aren't gonna be able to experience it for reals.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, and you know, now we got lossless compression and whatnot, but
it'll feel like when they do those haptic touch, you'll be like, oh, it smells and feels like paper.
Oh my gosh,
it'll be there.
Kind of exciting.
You know that's coming.
It'll be
lossless. You'll be able to press a button and no. You'll be able to smell your screen and it will always have that new book smell.
Yeah, and every time you open it, you get to be the first one to break the back.
Yes,
oh,
you see,
feeling.
There you go.
Oh
man, I hate breaking the backs of books.
That's so funny. No. When we worked at the textbook, office over the summers, where we worked for our high school textbook office, repairing and prepping textbooks, and that was like the best part of the job. Was they'd get these we'd get hundreds of new textbooks, and the first thing I would do is you'd take a textbook and you just open it up right in the middle, like, oh, break the back, yeah, I get to be the first one. It was such a good feeling. I can't believe you don't like that stuff. I loved that. But I guess I'm different. I can't break the back on my e-reader anymore. Well, I could, but that'd be really disappointing. But I guess, I don't know.
You can do
just,
it once
and
really enjoy it.
Yeah. I guess what my thought is, well, it's just weird. It's like the idea of not having books on your bookshelf anymore, or not having bookshelves in general. Or, you know, our kids are going to be like, why do we call them bookshelves? Because there was a time when you stored books on them. What are books? They're the things that are... I can't believe I need to explain this. but, you know, it's...
Dude, it's
going to
be
those...
like that with CDs and DVDs.
Well, exactly. I mean, it's why is the symbol for playing music and DVDs this round circular object? I don't get it. because actually I think it'll be the play button from now on, but it's making that transition as it were. But I guess what my point is I get, you know, I don't know if it's a bad thing. It's actually probably not a bad thing at all, but it's just sort of bummer. I like bookstores. I like the feel of a bookstore. I like going in, looking around, buying
some
coffee.
Like I said, imagine you open up the iBookstore and it smells like a bookstore. You even got the fresh coffee smell.
Yeah, but it's different. It's different.
I know.
It's very difficult to be pretentious.
And
when
then
you're
we'll have Google Glasses, and you'll put those on, and it'll be like, go to bookstore, and all of a sudden it'll turn to like holographic 3D. Be like, all right, I'm inside a bookstore. It smells like a bookstore. I can hear it. I'm reading a book right now because you just put my hands out and words magically appear.
Yeah.
It's going to be amazing.
It's going to be amazing, I guess. I don't know. Yeah, it's one of those things where it can't not happen. It's happening. There's no way around it. And, you know, the future of bookstores is going to be the Rasputins of music, or your small specialty stores that still do music, or they'll become, you know, I don't know, libraries. But libraries are going to be weird places too, because eventually libraries will just be, there'll be two things. There'll be a bunch of computers or stuff that, it'd basically be a bunch of computers of one form or another, and showers for homeless people, and, you know.
Study rooms.
Right. Study rooms, exactly.
Newspapers are the other one that you're kind of like, that's going to be a bummer.
It can't last, but, yeah, it can't last. And you know what the one thing that is true about things that can't last? They won't. It's just a matter of time, I think, before you see the trend and the transition away from these things. And
but
they
you're
all
good,
man.
You're on the Kindle wave, so
but
it's all
just,
fine.
I don't know. Bookstores, they're so cool.
Bookstores.
Of course, what's funny about this is that if this were like 30 years ago and Barnes & Noble was on the warpath to crushing all your mom-and-pop stores, the disappointment would be like, oh, they're getting rid of all the mom-and-pop bookstores. This is horrible, this wave of the future. And now we're like nostalgic and feeling bad about Barnes & Nobles because they're not going to survive the Amazon
tides
onslaught.
Have turned.
I know, it's funny. It's you don't really miss it until it's, man... Well, it's the King of the Hill thing, you know? You're watching the King of the Hill topple, and you're like, oh, now I feel bad for them. They used to be the King of the Hill. I don't know.
So another, I wouldn't say they're king yet, but they're on their way. Definitely the prince, or perhaps the belle of the ball is a better way to think about it. Square is continuing to kick butts and take names.
Yeah.
They announced that you'll now be able to buy their little card readers inside of Starbucks. So Starbucks is going to start taking. They will be accepting payments via Square, and then you will be able to accept payments via Square by buying a little card reader at their 7,000 stores.
Nice.
That's a lot.
That's a ton.
Yeah. They cost $10 to buy.
That ain't bad.
But, and it gets even better, there's a $10 credit that you can redeem. So
they're basically free.
Yes. And so as long as you use it once, no problem. If you never use it, okay, it costs you $10.
I pay myself money?
Sure. I don't think they care.
Well,
they do get their cut. You know, they're
2.5%
or whatever it is.
Right.
So I guess you look at it that way, you're like, all right, it costs you a little bit.
Right, yeah,
cents.
That's if you do a transition with yourself, a transaction with yourself, you actually use it for its intended purpose,
and the retailer pays it. Yeah.
Right.
So, pretty sweet. I like what they're doing.
And it's funny. I still think that the coolest part about it is how simple their technology is. I mean, it's which is amazing to me because I've had conversations with people just in the last couple of weeks where like had no idea how they read cards. Which I guess what it comes down to is like I've spent more time than your average person studying card readers and how they work and trying to figure it out and and understanding it and how they're reprogrammed and everything. And, you know, one of those weird, like, rabbit holes that I've dug into, just go, where does this lead? So, like, to me, like, the idea of how it works is really, it's, you know, it's basically a tape deck running on your, you know, your phone, and so you just listen to the sound. Like, but it is super simple because they're so simple, and they are very affordable because it literally is just a tape deck reader is all it is. And then they wrote, which is one of the cheapest pieces of technology out there. You can manufacture them for 10 cents, you know, in China.
Which
they do. The biggest cost is shipping. Yeah, the biggest cost is shipping. They're very reliable, and then you just need a little cool piece of code that can dissect the sound and do a little signal processing, which, I don't know, is one of the best, you know, studied areas of technology. It's one of those things where it's just so stable. It's so incredibly stable. And, you know, it that's the sort of thing that calls into question the whole e-wallet, you know. Well, not really. I still think there's a place for the e-wallet, but,
well, and you still, like, gotta use your credit card, but I mean, right. Well, at least initially.
But it, you know, but it's one of those things where, man, that's, I love stuff like that because it is the, like, the apex of innovation in that it's incredibly simple. They just put the different components together and now they make a gazillion dollars, and I think they deserve every penny of it because it's really cool. And it gives the power of commerce to the people. Bring the power to the people. That's the whole point of the, you know, personal computing revolution. Oh, man. I like those guys.
Me too.
Man. So, cool. Avis bought Zipcar. How do you feel about that?
Well, I've never used Zipcar. And okay. I probably never will.
But you wanted to, right? I mean, you were... What?
Yeah, if I could figure out, okay, it's not going to happen, but if I could figure out how to live life like I were in a big city, but not in a big city, that would be awesome.
Yeah, that's particularly difficult because life in a big city is that way because you live in a big city.
I know. So,
it's one of those, if your aunt had, you know, male parts, then she'd be your uncle.
Yeah, no, I get it. So I guess there are certain parts about living in a city that I am attracted to, and certain parts that I don't like. And if I could get rid of those parts, like the people, that would be awesome. But like you said, right? They come hand in hand because of the people. They have different solutions, and yeah, I get it. Whatever. And I know that I dislike the crowds enough that I'm going to miss out on the other cool things. And you accept that as my personal life story and move on. Zipcars is one of those things that I wish that I could participate in. I mean, obviously I could, but it would make zero financial sense for me to do it because I own two cars already. And there are no Zipcar locations near me. Because it doesn't make sense in my small town. So I think the idea is very cool. And it's one step away from the complete sharing economy, like that dog vacay I was talking about. It's similar to it, which I was kind of pumped that we got to try it. Now I really want to try Airbnb, by the way.
Yeah.
Just because it was very cool. But all that to say, like, you know, I don't know what Avis's plans are with them. Is it their intent to keep the Zipcar brand and to just bolster it and really help it thrive and take off and, you know, just earn buku bucks off of it?
That's my question. I don't really know. And that's to me is the concern. Are they trying to protect their turf because they want to keep the rental car business, so they're just going to buy out anything that could change that model? Or do they realize that this is a hugely profitable model and they have a fleet of cars that can turn it from a couple of big cities into a really diverse network of cars, and they can, you know, bring it all over the world, and then this can be the new way to do it. I don't know. I mean, I don't know what the plan is. I don't know if they know what the plan is. You know, it's going to feel it out as they go to some degree.
I think I'd love to see Avis become more like Zipcar, I think, than the other way around. Yeah. I was just real quickly scanning one of the comments, and You know, he was saying if they supplement Zipcar with point-to-point and long-term rentals instead of rent and return, he goes, I'd be pretty happy. You know, he's going, he likes Zipcar, and it could definitely improve in those areas. And I could see something like that where, you know, theoretically, Zipcar just got a bunch of different cars added to their, or, you know, when it closes later. Yeah, to their fleet, which is one of their big problems, is it's just not big enough because, you know, buying cars is not easy.
Yeah, it's gigantic capital expenses.
Yeah, and so, you know, they have a whole bunch of access to that, which is nice. But I don't know. I'm intrigued for sure, and I'm going to be positive and think that Avis has good plans for them, and they're not just going to kill a competitor because I don't think they view them as a competitor. I think they truly view them as a complimentary service, which I guess that's in this huge quote here. We see car sharing as highly complementary to traditional car rental. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
I'm okay with it. $500 million? That's not bad.
$500 billion.
$500 million, you know, that's good for them. I think Zipcar's public too, aren't they?
I don't know.
Yeah, I think they are, and their stocks hasn't been doing excellent. But there it is. Yeah. All right, man, I'm giving you one more.
Una mas, okay.
And I probably should have broke it up at some point in time, but that's okay.
Yeah, that's all right. Next time. Oh, FTC. So this is kind of cool. The FTC basically came out this week, and they said, Google does not unfairly favor their own services, which is really important, because if they did, that would be abusing a monopoly. And or that could be the grounds for abuse of a monopoly, and then that's how you get into antitrust lawsuits, and they break up Google, which would be a bad thing. So they basically have to go like way out of their way to have genuine results where Google doesn't show up. You know, if you type in email into your browser, Gmail doesn't pop first above everything else. And actually, what's really weird is if you Google search engine. A lot of times it doesn't even show up at all as the search results. You're like,
search engine. Dogpile is my number one.
Yeah, me too.
Wikipedia, number two. Custom Google search is number three. The comprehensive list of search engines. Then Bing. Then AltaVista. Then Search Engine Watch. DuckDuckGo.
See, Wikipedia is my number two, and Bing is my number three. Wolfram Alpha is my number four. That's how I roll.
XI Yahoo Quick, and then the 15 most popular search engines.
Yeah, but it's interesting. I mean, this is a bigger, you know, this is obviously a bigger issue than just search engine. But
what if I type in Google?
But it's you know, it's one of those things where. They basically, if you go into email, if you just type email, Yahoo, mail.yahoo.com comes up first, Gmail comes up next.
I got but, Yahoo, Gmail, Spokio. Yeah, okay. YouTube.
Yeah.
How to do an email address search.
Yeah. If you type video, that's awesome. If you type video, Google Videos comes up first, not even YouTube. I thought Google Videos doesn't exist anymore.
Well, so I got Google Video. It's Video HP. What is that?
I don't know.
Hey, Yancey, you're number two on my list. Nice. Google Videos. HP.
But, I don't know. That's one of those. It's definitely something that Google had to manage carefully and well, which was to, you know, to not abuse their position of power at being the number one search engine. Give other people a fair shot, and they it looks like they did. Cool. And yeah, nice job, Google. Woohoo!
See, that's why they're going to be fair with Android, you know.
Yeah, sure. Okay, do you want to get into the Google blocking maps on Windows phones?
Touche.
Now it's a fun one, but it sort of settled itself at the end of the week, so I didn't want to get into it too much, but they're not exactly playing nice with Microsoft right now at all. I mean, they're being rather brutal in, you know, a couple of degrees actually, but but that one's still kind of shaking out, so I didn't want to. I figured if it becomes a thing in the next week or two, we'll get into it. But okay. I was gonna let it just slide this week.
But you got your dig in, so that's all right.
Exactly. That's the important part. I just want our audience to know we pay attention to everything. We actually... I decide to not talk about stuff, not because we didn't notice it, but because we either think it's actually unimportant or it, you know, just hold on. We'll get there.
Or it's so obvious.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah, sometimes.
Sometimes.
Exactly. Sometimes just assume that if we didn't talk about it, we know it... We just decide. We actually intentionally did it. You know, ignored it for whatever reason.
Yeah. Cool beans, man. Cool beans.
All right.
So, thanks everybody for putting up with this little experiment. We'll see how it goes. We'll see how much energy I have to post-process everything too. We'll find out. So, with that, everyone, welcome to the new year. We'll be doing some experimenting on our end, trying to improve the show, listening to your listener feedback. It'll be good. So, as you've probably figured out by now, I am James Furlow, and my brother is Matthew Furlow. So, we'll talk next time. And now we get to decide, do we do the cool music, or I should say the new music, or the old music?